The Castle Rock Laverdier Super Drugstore was a lot more than just a drugstore. Put another way, it was really only a drugstore as an afterthought. It was as if someone had noticed at the last moment, just before the grand opening, say, that one of the words in the sign was still drug. That someone might have made a mental note to tell someone else, someone in the company's management, that here they were, opening yet another Laverdier's, and they had, by simple oversight, neglected yet again to correct the sign so it read, more simply and accurately, Laverdier's Superstore. And, after making the mental note, the someone in charge of noticing such things had delayed the grand opening a day or two so they could shoehorn in a prescription counter about the size of a telephone booth in the long building's furthest, darkest, and most neglected corner. The Laverdier's Super Drugstore was really more of a jumped-up five-and-dime than anything else. The town's last real five-and-dime, a long, dim room with feeble, fly-specked overhead globes hung on chains and reflected murkily in the creaking but often waxed wooden floor, had been the Ben Franklin store. It had given up the ghost in 1978 to make way for a video games arcade called Galaxia and Easy Video Rentals, where Tuesday was Twofer's Day, and no one under the age of 20 could go in the back room. Laverdier's carried everything the old Ben Franklin had carried, but the goods were bathed in the pitiless light of maxi-glow fluorescent bars, which gave every bit of stock its own hectic, feverish shimmer. "Buy me," each item seemed to shriek. "Buy me, or you may die, or your wife may die, or your kids, or your best friend, possibly all of them at once. Why? How should I know? I'm just a brainless item sitting on a prefab Laverdier shelf. But doesn't it feel true? You know it does. So buy me, and buy me right now." There was an aisle of notions, two aisles of first aid supplies and nostrums, an aisle of video and audio tapes, both blank and pre-recorded. There was a long rack of magazines giving way to paperback books, a display of lighters under one digital cash register, and a display of watches under another. A third register was hidden in the dark corner where the pharmacist lurked in his lonely shadows. Halloween candy had taken over most of the toy aisle. The toys would not only come back after Halloween, but eventually take over two whole aisles as the days slid remorselessly down towards Christmas. And like something too neat to exist in reality, except as a kind of dumb admission that there was such a thing as fate with a capital F, and that fate might in its own way indicate the existence of that whole other world about which Pop had never before cared, except in terms of how it might fatten his pocketbook, that was, and about which Kevin Delavan had never before even thought. At the front of the store, in the main display area, was a carefully arranged work of salesmanship, which was billed as the Fall Photo Festival. This display consisted of a basket of colorful autumn leaves spilled out on the floor in a bright flood, a flood too large actually to have come from that one basket alone, a careful observer might have concluded. Amid the leaves were a number of Kodak and Polaroid cameras, several Sun 660s among the latter, and all sorts of other equipment. Cases, albums, film, flash bars. In the midst of this odd cornucopia, an old-fashioned tripod rose, like one of H.G. Wells's Martian death machines towering over the crispy wreck of London. It bore a sign which told all patrons interested enough to look that this week one could obtain super reductions on all Polaroid cameras and accessories. At 8:30 that morning, half an hour after Laverdier's opened for the day, all patrons consisted of Pop Merrill and Pop alone. He took no notice of the display, but marched straight to the only open counter, where Molly Durham had just finished laying out the watches on their imitation velvet display cloth. "Oh no, here comes old Eyeballs," she thought, and grimaced. Pop's idea of a really keen way to kill a stretch of time about as long as Molly's coffee break was to kind of ooze up to the counter where she was working. He always picked hers, even if he had to stand in line. In fact, she thought he liked it better when there was a line, and buy a pouch of Prince Albert tobacco. This was a purchase an ordinary fellow could transact in 30 seconds, but if she got Eyeballs out of her face in under 3 minutes, she thought she was doing very well indeed. He kept all of his money in a cracked leather purse on a chain, and he'd haul it out of his pocket, giving his doorbells a good feel on the way it always looked to Molly. and then open it. It always gave out a little screak noise. And honest to God, if you didn't expect to see a moth flutter out of it. Just like in those cartoons people draw of tightwads. On top of the purse's contents, there would be a whole mess of paper money. Bills that looked somehow as if you shouldn't handle them. As if they might be coated with disease germs of some kind. And jingling silver underneath. Pop would fish out a dollar bill, and then kind of hook the other bills to one side with one of those thick fingers of his to get to the change underneath. He'd never give you a couple of bucks. Uh-uh. That would make everything too quick to suit him. And then he'd work that out, too. And all the time, his eyes would be busy, flicking down to the purse for a second or two, but mostly letting the fingers sort out the proper coins by touch while his eyes crawled over her boobs, her belly, her hips, and then back up to her boobs again. Never once her face, not even so far as her mouth, which was a part of a girl in which most men seemed to be interested. No, Pop Merrill was strictly interested in the lower portions of the female anatomy. When he finally finished, and no matter how quick that was, it always seemed like three times as long to Molly, and got the hell out of the store again, she always felt like going somewhere and taking a long shower. So she braced herself, put on her best, "It's only 8:30 and I've got 7.5 hours to go," smile, and stood at the counter as Pop approached. She told herself, "He's only looking at you. Guys have been doing that since you sprouted." And that was true, but this wasn't the same, because Pop Merrill wasn't like most of the guys who had run their eyes over her trim and eminently watchable superstructure since that time 10 years ago. Part of it was that Pop was old, but that wasn't all of it. The truth was that some guys looked at you and some, a very few, seemed to actually be feeling you up with their eyes, and Merrill was one of those. His gaze actually seemed to have weight when he fumbled in his creaky old maid's purse on its length of incongruously masculine chain. She seemed to actually feel his eyes squirming up and down her front, lashing their way up her heels on their optic nerves like tadpoles and then sliding bonelessly down into her valleys, making her wish she had worn a nun's habit to work that day, or maybe a suit of armor. But her mother had been fond of saying, "What can't be cured must be endured, sweet Molly." And until someone discovered a method of weighing gazes, so those of dirty men both young and old could be outlawed, or more likely, until Pop Merrill did everyone in Castle Rock a favor by dying so that eyesore of a tourist trap he kept could be torn down, she would just have to deal with it as best she could. But today, she was in for a pleasant surprise, or so it seemed at first. Pop's usual hungry appraisal was not even an ordinary patron's look. It seemed utterly blank. It wasn't that he looked through her, or that his gaze struck her and bounced off. It seemed to Molly that he was so deep in his thoughts that his usually penetrating look did not even reach her, but made it about halfway and then petered out, like a man trying to locate and observe a star on the far side of the galaxy with just the naked eye. "May I help you, Mr. Merrill?" she asked, and her feet were already cocking so she could turn quickly and reach up for where the pouches of tobacco were kept. With Pop, this was a task she always did as quickly as possible, because when she turned and reached, she could feel his eyes crawling busily over her ass, dropping for a quick check of her legs, and rising again to her butt for a final ocular squeeze and perhaps a pinch before she turned back. "Yes?" he said calmly and serenely. And he might as well have been talking to one of those automated bank machines, for all the interest in her he showed. That was fine by Molly. "I'd like some..." And then either a word she didn't hear right, or one that was utter gibberish. If it was gobbledygook, she thought with some hope, maybe the first few parts of the complicated network of dikes, levees, and spillways the old croc had constructed against the rising sea of senility were finally giving way. It sounded as if he had said, "Tophil Maco," which wasn't a product they stocked unless it was a prescription drug of some sort. "I beg pardon, Mr. Merrill?" "Film," he said, so clearly and firmly that Molly was more than disappointed. She was convinced he must have said it just that way the first time, and her ears had picked it up wrong. Maybe she was the one who was beginning to lose her dikes and levees. What kind would you like?
Polaroid, he said. 2 packs.
She didn't know exactly what was going on here, but it was beyond doubt that Castle Rock's premier dirty old man was not himself today. His eyes would still not focus, and the words, they reminded her of something, something she associated with her 5-year-old niece, Ellen, but she couldn't catch hold of it.
For what model, Mr. Merrill?
She sounded brittle and actressy to herself, but Pop Merrill didn't even come close to noticing. Pop was lost in the ozone. After a moment's consideration, in which he did not look at her at all, but seemed instead to study the racks of cigarettes behind her left shoulder, he jerked out,
"For a Polaroid Sun Camera Model 660.
And then it came to her. Even as she told him she'd have to get it from the display, her niece owned a big, soft panda toy, which she had, for reasons which would probably make sense only to another little girl, named Paulette. Somewhere inside of Paulette was an electronic circuit board and a memory chip, on which were stored about 400 short, simple sentences, such as,
"I like to hug, don't you?"
and
"I wish you'd never go away."
Whenever you poked Paulette above her fuzzy little navel, there was a brief pause, and then one of those lovesome little remarks would come out, almost jerk out, in a somehow remote and emotionless voice that seemed by its tone to deny the content of the words. Ellen thought Paulette was nuts. Molly thought there was something creepy about it. She kept expecting Ellen to poke the panda doll in the gut someday, and it would surprise them all, except for Aunt Molly from Castle Rock, by saying what was really on its mind.
"I think tonight, after you're asleep, I'll strangle you dead."
Perhaps. Or maybe just,
"I have a knife."
Pop Merrill sounded like Paulette the stuffed panda this morning. His blank gaze was uncannily like Paulette's. Molly had thought any change from the old man's usual leer would be a welcome one. She had been wrong. Molly bent over the display, for once totally unconscious of the way her rump was poking out, and tried to find what the old man wanted as quickly as she could. She was sure that when she turned around, Pop would be looking at anything but her. This time, she was right. When she had the film and started back, brushing a couple of errant fall leaves from one of the boxes, Pop was still staring at the cigarette racks, at first glance appearing to look so closely he might have been inventorying the stock. It took a second or two to see that that expression was no expression at all, really, but a gaze of almost divine blankness.
"Please get out of here," Molly prayed. "Please just take your film and go, and whatever else you do, don't touch me, please."
If he touched her while he was looking like that, Molly thought she would scream. Why did the place have to be empty? Why couldn't at least one other customer be in here? Preferably Sheriff Pangborn, but since he seemed to be otherwise engaged, anyone at all. She supposed Mr. Constantine, the pharmacist, was in the store someplace, but the drug counter looked easily a quarter of a mile away. And while she knew it couldn't be that far, not really, it was still too far for him to reach her in a hurry if old man Merrill decided to touch her. And suppose Mr. Constantine had gone out to Nan's for coffee with Mr. Keaton from the selectman's office. The more she thought about that possibility, the more likely it seemed. When something genuinely weird like this happened, wasn't it an almost foregone conclusion that it should happen while one was alone? He's having a mental breakdown of some kind. She heard herself saying with glassy cheerfulness, "Here you are, Mr. Merrill." She put the film on the counter and scooted to her left and behind the register at once, wanting it between her and him. The ancient leather purse came out of Pop Merrill's pants, and her stuttering fingers miskeyed the purchase, so she had to clear the register and start again. He was holding 2 $10 bills out to her. She told herself they were only rumpled from being squashed up with the other bills in that little pocketbook, probably not even old, although they looked old. That didn't stop her galloping mind, however. Her mind insisted that they weren't just rumpled, they were rumpled and slimy. It further insisted that old wasn't the right word, that old wasn't even in the ballpark. For those particular items of currency, not even the word ancient would do. Those were prehistoric tens, somehow printed before Christ was born and Stonehenge was built, before the first low-browed, no-neck Neanderthal had crawled out of his cave. They belonged to a time when even God had been a baby. She didn't want to touch them. She had to touch them. The man would want his change. Steeling herself, she took the bills and shoved them into the cash register as fast as she could, banging a finger so hard she ripped most of the nail clear off. An ordinarily exquisite pain she would not notice in her extreme state of distress until sometime later, when that was, she had chivied her willing mind around enough to scold herself for acting like a whoopsie little girl on the edge of her first menstrual period. At the moment, however, she only concentrated on getting the bills into the register as fast as she could and getting her hand off them. But even later she would remember what the surfaces of those tens had felt like. It felt as if they were actually crawling and moving under the pads of her fingers, as if billions of germs, huge germs, almost big enough to be seen with a naked eye, were sliding along them toward her, eager to infect her with whatever he had. But the man would want his change. She concentrated on that, lips pressed together so tightly they were dead white, four singles that did not, absolutely did not want to come out from beneath the roller that held them down in the cash drawer. Then a dime. But, oh, Jesus, please us, there were no dimes. And what the hell was wrong with her? What had she done to be settled for so long with this weird old man on the one morning in recorded history when he actually seemed to want to get out of here in a hurry? She fished out a nickel, feeling the silent, stinky loom of him so close to her, and she felt that when she was finally forced to look up, she would see he was even closer, that he was leaning over the counter toward her. Then three pennies, four, five. But the last one dropped back into the drawer among the quarters, and she had to fish for it with one of her cold, numb fingers. It almost squirted away from her again. She could feel sweat popping out on the nape of her neck and on the little strip of skin between her nose and her upper lip. Then, clutching the coins tightly in her fist and praying he wouldn't have his hand outstretched to receive them so she would have to touch his dry, reptilian skin, but knowing, somehow knowing that he would, she looked up, feeling her bright and cheery Laverdiere smile stretching the muscles of her face in a kind of frozen scream, trying to steel herself for even that, telling herself it would be the last, and never mind the image her stupid, insisting mind kept trying to make her see, an image of that dry hand suddenly snapping shut over hers like the talon of some old and horrid bird. A bird not of prey, no, not even that, but one of carrion. She told herself she did not see those images, absolutely did not, and seeing them all the same, she looked up with that smile screaming off her face as brightly as a cry of murder on a hot, still night. And the store was empty. Pop was gone. He had left while she was making change. Molly began to shudder all over. If she had needed concrete proof that the old geezer was not right, this was it. This was proof positive, proof indubitable, proof of the purest ray serene. For the first time in her memory, and in the living memory of the town, she would have bet, and she would have won her bet, Pop Merrill, who refused to tip even on those rare occasions when he was forced to eat in a restaurant that had no takeout service, had left a place of business without waiting for his change. Molly tried to open her hand and let go of the four ones, the nickel, and the five pennies. She was stunned to find she couldn't do it. She had to reach over with her other hand and pry the fingers loose. Pop's change dropped to the glass top of the counter, and she swept it off to one side, not wanting to touch it. And she never wanted to see Pop Merrill again.